Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by ITV's international affairs editor, Raghi Omar. After establishing a strong reputation for reporting from Somalia and Iraq for the BBC, he moved to Al Jazeera and later presented his own investigative documentary series. He started at ITV in 2013 as a special correspondent and was promoted to his current role a year later. He is now a regular presenter on their flagship news programmes, including News at 10. He has also written two books and has twice been nominated in the Services to Media category at the British Muslim Awards. Raghi, thank you for joining me.
It's a pleasure.
So, Raghi, we live in a globally volatile era now. It must be a great time to be ITV's international affairs editor.
It is. It's a busy time. I mean, one person said, we're in this sort of era, we'll never be out of a job.
Stuff's happening all the time.
All the time. News. I mean, I remember, in 2001, beginning of 2001, I'd got a job as a correspondent in Africa, having been born in Africa. That was just a dream, job, and moved to Johannesburg, with my wife and daughter, who was just 6 months at the time. And I thought, I'm going to be covering this enormous, varied, fascinating, continent, which is home and where many of my relatives still live, and work, as my sister's a human rights lawyer and she, covered, Rwanda and the war crimes trials. My brother was a businessman, later became a politician. So this was a place that
an
was...
an incredibly high-achieving family.
No, thank you. But, really close to home. A few months later, I was in our living room in Johannesburg, and my wife said, you've got to come and have a look at this. And I just remember right now, crystal clear as though it was yesterday, watching some smoke coming out of the Twin Towers. And I thought it looked like a sort of, a fire, what's going on? And then, as I was sort of, wondering what was happening, the second plane, went in.
Wow, so you actually watched live the second plane?
I watched it, and I just watched the whole sort of drama sort of unfold. And I just remember my utter sort of, shock and disbelief with everyone, watching at that moment when they came down. And I just thought, first of all, my entire world sort of, changed as a professional sort of world. I didn't cover Africa for the next, 9-10 months. I was flying between Johannesburg and Afghanistan, and then very soon after that, between Johannesburg and Iraq. And I thought to myself at that time, you will never experience, a period of your professional life as seismic, as, life sort of changing, as busy as that time. And then today I sort of find myself, even sort of, busier, with the world in even more flux. So it's an extraordinary time to be reporting the world as an international affairs editor for, the biggest commercial broadcaster in Europe.
What have been the most memorable stories that you've worked on since 9/11? Because, I mean, you have been all over the planet and put yourself in some quite considerable danger. I remember, as you were talking about some of those reports, I remember seeing you deliver them to screen. Mm. How do you maintain that, the duality of being a reporter but also being a human being as well?
I mean, of course you
don't.
There's
like eight questions
It is a bit. But you don't, Paul. I mean, the reality is you don't. I mean, you try and not be personalized and selective in your reporting in terms of what you put to air, but of course there's always a lot of you and how you react, especially if you're seeing people who've lost their lives, their homes, children who are at death's door because of disease and illness. I mean, these are very, very traumatic things. You would not be human if you didn't put something of your sort of emotion and yourself, into that. But it's funny because I started life at the BBC, and of course, you're put in a sort of incubator at the BBC
to be
BBC-ized,
indoctrinated.
and it is an incredibly important sort of training. But the fact is, if you and I got on a plane today and we went to wherever, Gaza or Eastern Europe or Washington, and we witnessed exactly the same thing and we had to do the same report together, of course you'd put your, you'd put Paul's view of what you saw and what mattered, and I'd put my view of what's important, that what matters. So you try your best to not give your bent or spin or personal sort of thing on an event, but inevitably, as a journalist, you weigh up you know, what you feel is important of what you've seen. But of course, the other side is the emotional side of what you sort of witnessed and things that you know, stay with you forever. And that's something you deal with or find ways of sort of dealing with that are difficult. It takes you years to sort of, you know, process that. The one thing, though, and I get asked this question is, you know, when you've seen someone shot or, you know, someone's died or, you know, something horrific and awful, you know, how can you, how do you recover from something like that?
Yeah, because you could rightly suffer from PTSD.
But absolutely. But the thing is, it's going to sound sort of weird. You go into work mode. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, that is my office. That's where I work. That's where I try and report. It's also something that we love doing. But that's just one of the sort of costs. And the other thing is you've got to bear in mind is that it's a cliche, but it is absolutely true. When you are in places like Iraq or Afghanistan or, you know, refugee camps, you see the best of humanity and not just always the worst. And that's in the form of many. You see uplifting sort of humor, even in the most sort of ghastly, awful sort of places. I wouldn't want people listening to this to think we're all just, you know,
miserable,
yeah, guts and so forth. They're just amazing, really funny places. I remember I was with a friend of mine who's a, you know, incredibly talented and, you know, multi-award-winning sort of cameraman at a party recently. And he said, do you remember that time I took that piece to camera in Kabul? And basically, I got the last ever visa that the Taliban issued when they were in power in 2001. So just as, you know, so it was a couple of months after 9/11, the Americans and, you know, international powers invaded Afghanistan to overthrow the Taliban, December 2001. So I got into Kabul with William Reeve, and we were the only journalists, Western journalists, in Kabul in the last days of the Taliban. You know, and thousands of other sort of colleagues were, you know, coming in with the Northern Alliance and so forth. So Fred was the cameraman, Fred Scott, and he said, "Look, I need to." We were at the hotel above Kabul, taking a shot, you know, of the city, saying, you know, how many more hours, you know, has this city got left before, you know, Western forces and the Northern Alliance sort of arrive. And he needed a reflector held, you know, so because it was sort of backlit and all that. And there were these guys who were had bandoleros, you know, huge sort of, you know, beards, Kalashnikovs, who were, one of them was holding a light, and the other one was holding a reflector while we did the piece of camera. And so, and then Fred thought, just for posterity, I've got to take a picture of this, you know, just what goes into. So there are bizarre, weird, you know, moments like that when you've got these sort of, you know, guerrilla fighters acting as assistant cameramen for you. So it's a fantastic, you know, life. Of course, people will concentrate on, you know, when they ask you personal questions, you know, what's it really like to see, you know, as I did, you know, only last year, the famine, you know, the impending sort of famine in the Horn of Africa, and going to therapeutic feeding centres and looking at children who really, really you thought they were not going to survive.
It's heartbreaking.
Yeah, it is. But you have to just reports because...
Well, you're doing them a favour by raising awareness of their plight.
I think that's the other thing, is that is the motivation. You know, someone has to see this. You know, policy makers, you know, people. And, you know, on the basis of that, the Disasters Emergency Committee came into sort of being, really based on, you know, the reports that we did at sort of ITV. The Secretary of State pitched in, you know, 10 million matching for the first 10 million that the public raised, and it got to 50-odd million pounds, you know, and that's the power of being in those sort of, you know, places. It's just one example. Of course, there are many others when you think, who's paid attention? You know, sometimes absolutely nothing happens and your reports, you know, just don't have a sort of effect. But often and hugely they do.
If this isn't a kind of daft question, how vulnerable do you feel when you're in the theatre of conflict? Because in one sense, you could become desensitised to it because you're there all the time dealing with it and you just have to... Or it might be that you massively increase your sensitivity to it, or do you just kind of get on with it? Because you're going to have... You know, reporters in the theatre of war out there seem to be more danger than ever before. You know, you could have had an orange jumpsuit put on you and been kidnapped and been tortured to death live on camera.
I think that's one of the things that's changed in my time as a, you know, correspondent, is that...
Is it the, the rules have changed.
The rules have changed, but also the sense of journalistic neutrality has been eroded, has been undermined to a breathtaking degree, where journalists now are a target.
A fair game. And before, like you said, they didn't used to be.
No.
But, you know, so-called Islamic State knows the PR value of kidnapping someone like you, who's well-known and off of the telly and all that.
Not just Islamic State. I mean, governments and guerrilla groups. I mean, barely a week ago, I interviewed, you know, colleagues of Marie Colvin, the Sunday Times correspondent.
Who was deliberately targeted by the Assad regime.
Targeted by the Assad regime. That is probably one of the most... If I was, you know, 20-something again, you know, and entering this profession, would I do so knowing what the enormous sort of costs, you know, are? When I sort of joined, you know, 20-odd years ago and got my sort of first breaks, you really did feel that, you know, when you were going to any part of the sort of, you know, Middle East, you know, the, you know, Israel-Palestinian sort of conflict, you know, all sides, wherever it was, you know, respected the idea that you were there neutrally doing your job, able to report from sort of both sides. Of course, there were deaths, you know, well before I sort of got in, but you weren't specifically targeted because people wanted to sort of silence you as much as journalists are today. I think that's one of the things that's changed.
And that just seems especially unfair.
I wouldn't say unfair, because I feel at times we as, you know, journalists, news organisations, have not helped ourselves at times. I mean, going back to the Iraq war in 2003, the whole issue of embedding, you know, came up in a way that it just never did. It was formalised. Do you remember? I mean, it's a long while ago. So, you know, to explain... particularly the US and UK military, but particularly the United States military, you know, said that if you wanted to report from the war and accompany US military forces, you had to embed, you know, literally travel with, go with, you know, stay with. You were absolutely there and part and parcel of that military unit as they sort of... Of course, you're independent. You know, you reported for whoever it was, you know, New York
but
Times,
BBC. But
they
controlled your movements, yeah,
exactly,
and what you're access to.
Yeah. And there was no
you couldn't
point
just
about,
wander off.
Exactly. You couldn't just wander off. Or, more importantly, you couldn't say, I need to spend 4 more hours here because I want to see what's happened in terms of whatever,
yeah,
civilian casualty. Exactly.
Just done,
you know,
yeah.
You just have to sort of go. And of course, there is inevitably, you know, a sense in which, you know, you're traveling with these young men, you know, seeing them come under fire, you're coming under fire with them. There is a close proximity in a way that is uncomfortable, you know, certainly for me. I can speak for myself.
Not quite Stockholm syndrome, but a little bit of quasi...
Of course you're going to empathise with them. Well. Yeah, well, of course you would. I mean, it's human nature, you know. But that, to me... Now, I could understand the arguments, because the arguments were we weren't going to be able to see the war without that, you know, because you were going to where the paratroopers or the, you know, Marines or whatever were going. That, to me, I can understand that argument, but it really changed the whole idea that you were neutral. And I think things like that began to sort of give the excuse to those people who wanted to target journalists, that you're part of that other sort of, you know, army. You're part of, you know, you see what I mean?
Absolutely.
It's just sort of undermining. It is unfair. Of course it's unfair. But you really have to, if you're going to be, you know, really look at it in a sort of cold light of day, did we, you know, as a professional body, did we take actions that, with hindsight, you could say... contributed to a broader sense of in which, you know, the idea of sort of, you know, journalism has sort of become undermined. Also, the other thing is that, you know, looking at the media landscape today, you have, you know, people screaming, you know, very clear ideological standpoints and that sort of BBCization, if you like. It's not just the BBC, of course, you know, lots of other news organisations are incredibly, you know, impartial, you know, accurate, strive to be. That's getting drowned out. And there's many different reasons, you know, for that. But we live in an age now in which to be a journalist is really to be, you know, bombarded from many different sides, not just from those in power.
No, and obviously you're a senior international affairs editor, so you'll be involved in the decisions as to whether to send other people to the theatre of war.
Yeah.
I mean, that must weigh especially heavy on you.
No, it's massively so. You know, one of the things, you're absolutely right. And the other thing that makes it really difficult is that it's very difficult to be a freelance journalist anymore because the risks are so high that when I got into sort of journalism, loads of people got their breaks being freelancers, going off to base yourself in this part of Africa or Asia, hoping to get a lucky break, you know, hoping that, you know, say, look, I'm going off on a journey, you know, here, can I write you something? Now, it's so sort of dangerous and so expensive because also journalism has had to adapt and news organisations have had to adapt because of the increasing dangers. You know, I often say that sometimes insurance companies have as much say in what gets covered in terms of international sort of, you know, news as much as sort of foreign editors at times. Because if I'm going with colleagues to Syria or whatever else, my bosses have an absolute duty of care and they are very, very careful to make sure that we have gone every kind of, you know, training that we could have done, every kind of sort of risk assessment, you know, that we have all the sort of, you know, life support sort of systems to be able to sort of do it. That's really, really expensive.
It is.
Just think about a sort of, you know, a flak jacket, a sort of, you know, an emergency medical pack. You know, you're talking thousands of pounds. The days when you could just bump around, as I did, you know, back in the sort of early 90s in the back of a sort of car, you know, no one had flak jackets back then, you know, at all. It was really Bosnia in which, you know, you started to sort of see flak jackets being used as, you know, part and parcel of your everyday reporting. So that element of journalism, being able to get into the business as a foreign correspondent, as a war correspondent, it's almost impossible, I think, you know. I mean, of course, there are still freelancers who go and base themselves in Kabul, but that's because there's already a huge media presence there.
But if I'm an editor and I'm going to send you to Kabul, despite all the protections and all the, you know, the flak jackets or whatever I'm going to get you, ultimately you're still going to be in much more danger. Hmm. And they have to balance that your proximity to danger with ultimately that if they play too safe and never send you anywhere, then these huge problems, geopolitical problems and all these, you know, won't get covered. So they have to balance,
absolutely,
you know, the reporter's right to go in there and raise awareness of this.
It's a calculation you make. I mean,
so a calculation I wouldn't want to make.
Yeah, well, we do. I mean, every single day, and it boils down to sometimes, you know,
how likely are you going to get killed?
Well, also it's a sixth sense.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to go down that road today. I've said that loads of times. You know, I've got the heebie-jeebies today. I just don't, you know, this is not the day. I'm sorry, I'm not going. And I know, though, that I will get absolute sort of support in making that call. And it could just be something as ephemeral as that. I don't want to go down that road. But one of the things we mustn't sort of leave out, Paul, and I think people don't often realise, is the fundamental. You always see, you know, me or, you know, Jeremy Bowen or, you know, Robert Moore or Johnny Irvine, all these sort of, you know, correspondents.
All incredible journalists.
Incredible journalists. Our lifeline, our lives, and I bet every single one of those they were in this room would say that to you, the reason why we, a lot of the times, stay alive is due to many things, but one of the most fundamental aspects is, and we call them, you know, our local sort of, you know, fixers, you know, colleagues who are journalists who are, you know, Afghans or, you know, Somalis or Syrians who are our guardian angels. You know, it's their country. They know the battle scenes. They know what areas and what roads. They know who the commanders are. You know, we've flown in from London. Of course, we've got a huge amount of information, but they often hold, you know, our lives in the cup of their hands, really. And that is the most fundamental relationship, I think, of modern journalism. And the reverse is true. Sometimes if that relationship is sad or, if, you know, you're working with someone who doesn't have that sort of, you know, diligence of care, it can go horribly wrong. But my life is really the story of the people I've sort of worked with who've allowed me to be an eyewitness. You know, I mean, it's not just, you don't just sort of fly in from London, you know, arrive in, you know, the outskirts of Damascus, start reporting and know absolutely everything. It's just that sixth sense sometimes, you know, just get a tap on the shoulder, come, we need to go. You know, there's little telltale signs, you know. There have been lots of sort of situations. I remember just being in Gaza a couple of years back during, you know, the bombardment of Gaza. And I was just busy working. You know, there were some airstrikes that had sort of, you know, come sort of quite close. There's an awful lot going on when you're reporting in a scene where there is conflict. But it just was my sort of Abed, you know, my sort of colleague, who just sort of tapped my shoulder and said, we need to go. I don't know what he saw, but there was some sense he got of, you know, the way people were behaving. Some guys had come out of a sort of, you know, a building. I didn't even know what the building was that the Israelis were sort of targeting, you know. But he just said we needed to go, and we left. And then just as we were sort of leaving, another huge strike came in, basically only about sort of, you know, 200-300 yards, you know, away. But he sensed something, that this was an important sort of building. The Israelis hadn't sort of hit it. They were coming back again, you know, for another strike. I mean, I wouldn't have known that. So that's just to give you one example of how your lives have sort of changed. Conversely, a colleague ended up being kidnapped because that relationship didn't work. You know, you've got to understand, we leave after every assignment. We go back, get on a flight, you know, go back to our home and, you know, well-paid job, etc. They stay in Syria or Afghanistan or whatever else.
Makes you realise just how lucky we are by accident of birth.
Absolutely.
That we can enjoy.
Absolutely. But also the other thing is sometimes, you know, it's such a, you know, what's in the news, you know, what's in the headlines just changes like the sort of wind. Sometimes, you know, you could be going to sort of a country or a region because, you know, it's on the international, you know, news agenda, and then suddenly it disappears. They've got families to support. They support them, obviously, by the local work that they do, but the fact that they work with international journalists is a massive part of, you know, and that one person working with ITV or BBC or New York Times will have 15, 20 people dependent on them. And sometimes we might not come back for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. And one time this colleague, his driver had obviously, you know, come under sort of, you know, pressure by the Taliban. And they said, we know you work for foreign journalists, you know, on this day you'll take that road. And he did, and, you know, he probably got some of the money himself.
Betrayed by those that were supposed to look after you.
Of course it happens, and of course, but you know, you've got to be realistic and understand that, you know, sometimes, you know, that's another point. I mean, journalists are worth a lot of money in people's eyes. A lot of the people that, you know, were captured by Islamic State were, you know, effectively sort of sold on, if you see what I mean. You were captured by a sort of, you know, one of the sort of groups, and you just get sold on to ultimately Al-Qaeda or, you know, ISIS. So that's when that relationship goes really bad, you know, is sometimes you're just a giant $400,000, you know, ransom in the eyes of someone. And it might be, you know, your driver, it might be your sort of translator, or it just might just be bad luck.
But the worst that can happen to me in any 1 week in my job is that someone might fall asleep during a PowerPoint presentation. You know, I know you laugh, but it's probably true. Yeah. I'm not in mortal danger. Mm. Is there an element of a kind of duality where, in one sense, it's almost thrilling that you're doing something of such important work that people might want to do that? Or is it actually where you think, no, that the novelty of that wore off within a few months and now I just need to mitigate any risk that I have because I don't want to get killed?
I think it's, well, it's both, but I'd be lying if I didn't say that this wasn't an incredibly vital, exhilarating, amazing calling. Of course it's exciting. It's the first draft of history. You're present at, you know, events and interviewing people that will be, you know, written about in history books. And the idea that, you know, I was there when ... is incredibly, you know, addictive. Who wouldn't? That's why we all go into it. Being with Yasser Arafat as he sort of, you know, came back after the Oslo, whatever it is, you know, seeing American troops as they entered sort of, Baghdad when the, you know, the statue of Saddam, you know, came down. You really do feel at the epicenter of, you know, global events. Having said that, I wouldn't continue to do this job if I didn't acknowledge that I was scared. You know, I'm really happy to be scared, and I think that's a lot of the reason why I'm still here.
Shows a respect for life, isn't it?
No, absolutely. I don't like being with people who, you know, aren't.
I've got a death wish.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And I think, you know, there are definitely some, of course there are, who are sort of what we sort of refer to as sort of, you know, metalheads or sort of, you know, headbangers. They are not that many. But also as you go on, you know, there's a sense in which your, you know, nine lives are sort of being used up. You know, we have, you know, journalists are not just there are some journalists for whom this is an all consuming
calling.
Yeah. And they're married to, you know, their calling. Many others are fathers, you know, wives, mothers, husbands, etc., etc. They have, you know, families. They have sort of, you know, relationship. And that, of course, changes you. Of course it does. It has to. And I certainly, you know, as my career has gone on, I'm just very careful about the sort of risk. Having said that, my daughter was just 2.5, I think, when I was decided to stay in Baghdad for the war. And my son was 11 months, you know, and I sort of, thinking back to that now, I was, what the hell were you
It's
you
not
know,
without
doing?
Personal cost, is it?
No, exactly. I also remember just as the war was starting, there were hundreds of journalists in Baghdad in 2003. And it looked, you know, it was quite clear for a long while that this invasion was going to go. And despite all the sort of the diplomacy at the sort of United Nations, you know, George W. Bush and, you know, Tony Blair had made the sort of commitment to, you know, go, you know, invade Iraq and overthrow sort of Saddam. But when Saddam Hussein and his two sons were given 48 hours to, the only way to avoid war was that if they sort of stood down and left the country. Well, that wasn't going to happen.
I remember the threat well.
Exactly. So that's when it suddenly became real for everyone who was still in Baghdad, you know. And it was announced that, you know, the Iraqis said, war's happening, the border is being closed. You know, no one will get into or out of Iraq as of that date. So the press corps in Baghdad was about 2,000, I think. I mean, from you know, all over the world. I mean, that talk about, you know, cameramen, correspondents, you know, reporters, satellite engineers, and you group all of us, you know, together. It's about 2,000. When that notification that, you know, this is not just real, but, you know, you've got to make a decision, are you staying or going? It suddenly went down from about 2,000 to a couple of hundred. That's quite a sobering moment when you sort of see a lot of very experienced, very decorated, wise, you know, brilliant sort of journalist saying,
turn on the heels and do one.
I'm going.
Yeah, I'm off.
And that's
what I don't blame them, frankly.
Of course I don't. But I didn't. And the reason why I didn't is that once I, you know, I was grappling with this, and by the time I made, this is a true story, why I ended up being in Baghdad. The moment I sort of thought, maybe actually it's a good time to go, it was too late. So border, because there was, who was it? It was one of my colleagues, was turned back at the border.
What stories have stayed with you? I mean, given that there's been so many things that you covered. I mean, I remember that you travelled the length and breadth of Somaliland recently, reporting on that catastrophic drought gripping the country. I can remember you doing that, and that stayed with me. And you're the actual you. I was just
things,
the viewer.
Lots of things have sort of stayed with me. But, you know, it's not the huge story that you sort of see. You know, it's not sort of, it's often just the sort of small things that don't make it to air that often sort of stay with you the most. And they're positive things as well. I don't want to sort of, you said earlier that, you know, I don't want people to think being a foreign correspondent, a war correspondent, is just a, you know, a bunch of sort of absolutely morbid misery guts, you know. They're amazing moments. I got the, one of the things I will always remember is interviewing Nelson Mandela. That was probably the only time so far in my career, immediately when I was told, you're going off and you're interviewing Nelson Mandela, and he said yes, you know, to interview. That instantly, when I heard that, I thought, I wish I could take my children. It's the only time I thought, I really, really, you know, more than anything, you know, more than me interviewing him, I want, you know, to take my sort of children with me. So I went to sort of Johannesburg. I wasn't living there anymore. This was around 2005, I think. And Madiba was, you know, no cobwebs on him still. You know, he was absolutely sharp as a sort of, you know,
I would have lost it.
I nearly did. But I went to his house, and because he said, I'll meet you at my house. And this is, you know, the word legendary historical, you know, legendary
is easily used,
but he really, you know, he was the real deal. Of course, I was absolutely gibbering wreck. You know, what
I would have been. I mean, I read Long Walk to Freedom.
Yeah.
And the genuine forgiveness that he had is something that it wouldn't be strong enough to do, given that what he went through.
I mean, he belongs in a very, very rare, genuine pantheon. You know, Martin Luther King, you know,
agreed.
Mahatma Gandhi. He is for the ages, you know. So we went to his house. I wanted to take every detail in, you know, what was his house like, and I was expecting, you know, look at this guy's sort of life, you know, he, you know, liberated, you know, a nation that many people thought would become a bloodbath, you know, were it not for him. So I was expecting, you know, pictures of, you know, him with the Pope, there was nothing, and not a single sort of, you know, picture of him. He didn't care for that at all. What there was, was in the corner was a small, a framed cartoon from the Sowetan newspaper, okay? And in it was basically, because we remember England was trying to win hosting the World Cup, right? And then we wanted South Africa's support. So David Beckham had been sent to schmooze Nelson Mandela, you know, Madiba, we really need your help. Please make sure South Africa votes for our bid. So this had just happened, you know, a little while earlier. And in Nelson Mandela's, the only picture he's got in his room, there's no, you know, him with presidents and world leaders, none of that. This cartoon showed a young black South African boy with his dad in their, you know, home in the township. And they're both watching TV. And on the TV is Nelson Mandela sitting next to David Beckham. And there's a little bubble coming out of the boy's mouth. And he's looking at his dad saying, "Dad, who's that old bloke with David Beckham?" And that was Nelson Mandela's, you know, that was the one thing he had in his room. And that just sort of captures him, because he really didn't take himself, you know, that seriously. He hated the kind of, you know, veneration and sort of worship. He's a very, very funny, funny man. I remember sort of South Africa at the time, before he died, you know, were really, you know, desperate. Any time he visited the doctor, the whole nation would hold its sort of breath. I remember him coming out and, you know, all these journalists were there and said, "Madiba, you know, what has the doctor said? Have they given you a clean bill of health?" And the journalists were asking really detailed sort of, you know, because, you know, the fate of the nation, we needed him to stay alive. And he was getting a bit bored with this behind his end. He goes, "Now, just a triple check, President, like, you've been, you know, examined thoroughly and given a clean bill." Because, "Well, I have not seen the gynecologist, but otherwise, yes, I've been." So he was just very, very, very funny.
Has being Somali-born made you more determined to bring Africa's story to viewers?
Yeah, I do. I think more than just being sort of, you know, being a Somali and having been born in Africa.
Because I was born in York, and I'm determined to, you know, have the north of England
absolutely
more heavily portrayed in the national news.
Because it's not just because I'm, you know, from there. Well, secondly, also, it's just a lot of very important sort of things, you know, international things, you know, the fight against the extremist Al-Shabaab. There's lots of things, you know, worthy going on there. And, you know, reporting it is not just to sort of to promote, you know, the Horn of Africa or whatever. It's to look at it warts and all. And I do. But I think it's the fact that you're reporting a place where, you know, relatives and loved ones who live and work there. It gives you a sort of just more of an insight, I think, reporting a place where it's different to going to a country which is entirely sort of, you know, alien to you, which you've never sort of been to before. But, you know, you're deployed there because it's in the sort of news. I think there are lots of sort of journalists who aren't African, who weren't born there, who also have this fascination with that continent, because it just is the most, every sort of story under the sun of the human sort of condition is this. It's a bewildering, magical, amazing place. But, you know, it's huge as well. I mean, I remember reporting in Sudan in 2004, 2005, 2006 with the Darfur crisis. And, you know, there's a conflict, you know, where the Sudanese government was basically ethnically cleansing, you know, people from Darfur. So Darfur's one province in Sudan. It's the size of France. You know, you just think of that. And there's another 51 sort of countries. I mean, Sudan is, you know, much bigger than all of Western Europe put together. And, you know,
which is just incredible when you think about it.
And there's two other countries which are slightly bigger, you know, who are also. So it's absolutely enormous. It's close to sort of home in lots of ways.
I mean, you once said that idealism has become a dirty word amongst journalists, but you still seem to me pretty idealistic, and yeah. I mean that as a compliment.
No, I am. I mean, you do get...
You've not become a curmudgeon.
Not quite. There's still time. There's still time. My idealism comes from just I'm a naturally optimistic person. I want to see, you know, the sense that there is optimism to be found in the human sort of, you know, condition. Also, the other thing I love about journalism, and, you know, this is absolutely true from the day I entered it, you're getting paid to pursue a career which is a continual education. You know, it's just amazing. You know, there's always something to learn, you know, a new country, a new issue to sort of discover. And it's just great fun. But also you just learn by meeting people, you know, and I love that. You know, I love, you know, travel. I love, you know, I'm naturally drawn to, you know, people, even in sort of very, very sort of, you know, odd and bizarre sort of circumstances. I'm not someone who just wants to stay in the sort of hotel and sort of go to press conferences. So I'll just sort of go out and wander around the market and all that kind of thing. I mean, that's the great fun of sort of journalism. It's like a continual sort of, you know, lifelong backpacking journey. But that you've got to have wanderlust. And I think wanderlust is fundamental to being a journalist. I think you've just got to see what's around the corner. Someone sort of, I think it was John Cole, the BBC's political editor back
legend.
In the sort of legend, he said journalism is the only profession where you can get on a plane, fly 5,000 miles, get out the airport, get in a car, drive for half an hour, get out of the taxi, walk down the street, turn left, and bump into 40 people you know really well.
Yeah.
So it's you know, and I think that kind of element of being part of a sort of, you know, traveling caravan, there's a lot of camaraderie in journalism. That's a wonderful thing. I've got a lot of very close friends, you know, through journalism, but we always see each other on the road. I mean, we really don't. I think we're sick and tired of each other by the time we get home to London. So the idea that we're all, well, of course, we do all go out for a drink or whatever, you know, catch up, but most of the time is spent on the road. And, you know, that's a sort of a phrase that's very central to being a journalist, you know, being on the road. Less and less, that bit is sort of wearing off. The romance of travel is certainly, in the age of, you know, terror, that romance of just, as I said, you know, bumping along the back of a sort of car somewhere, you know, that no one knows, you know, where you are, and, you know, you're sleeping under the stars in some, you know, desert. That romance has sort of gone because of safety, security, because, you know, journalism is sort of tight. It still exists. I mean, of course it does. But you do just also just get sometimes just tired of traveling, living out of a sort of hotel, living out of a suitcase.
Oh, and where do you see your career going? I mean, given that you've covered all of these amazing events. I mean, yeah. I was watching ITV News at 10 a couple of weeks ago, and you were presenting it, and I happened to name drop the fact that you were coming on the podcast to my friends who I was watching, and they were like, oh, incredibly impressed. Do you like being the news anchor? Is that something that, you know,
yeah,
that is ITN's flagship
show. It is.
And you are presenting it.
Well, I mean, which one of us didn't grow up watching, you know,
Sandy Gall
and Sandy Gall.
We've interviewed Trevor McDonald. He was amazing.
Trevor McDonald, you know, Reggie Bosanquet. Remember Reggie Bosanquet?
I don't actually.
Oh, right, okay. It's an amazing sort of program that has got an incredible heritage. And I feel incredibly lucky to be able to sort of sit in that chair presenting it. I'm very lucky in the sense that I'm, you know, able to sort of present, but I'm still an international affairs editor. And I also, you know, have developed over the years a love of doing longer features and documentaries. And I'm able to do all three at ITV, you know, presenting on assignment and the news at 10 and also reporting. It's just it's a great gig.
I mean, it's a big world out there, of course, but what's left for you to explore? What are the industries, the areas, the geographies?
I've never been one of those people that sort of, you know, writes one's career path on the back of an envelope. You know, age 20, this age, you know, must have won award X by, you know, then. I'm not sort of like that.
I used to do that, but it never gets you anywhere, really. You look at it years later and think, I didn't do any of that.
But I can be an incredibly sort of, you know, disorganized, you know, person. I'm, you know, a lot of my sort of, you know, family, colleagues and friends will attest to that. Even now, right now, after having travelled, I don't know, you know, how many countries I've been to, I've not sort of counted, but a lot, yeah, I still am a last-minute panic packer. I would be throwing stuff, you know, into the suitcase.
Do you not have a bag ready to go in the vestibule by the front door?
That is not a myth for some people, but for me, it's just kind of, I just chuck it in. If I've forgotten it, I'll try and grab it on my way through, you know, at duty free. I've got a very low boredom threshold.
But I mean, I remember you reported live from the royal wedding as well.
You're
doing a breadth of stories. Do you like doing the light as well as the shade?
Well, I mean, it was incredibly surprising. I mean, I tell you what, and I know this is true of a lot of correspondents. Some of them set out wanting to be presenters, you know, at some stage in their careers. But there's a lot of them who sort of regard presenting as not really, you know, not serious, you know, journalism. You've got to stay on the road and blah, blah, blah.
Well, Nick Mitchell, of course, moved from being the main anchor of the 6 o'clock news to the Royal Correspondent.
Exactly.
He did it the other way.
And there was a bit of me thinking, I can do that. It's just you're sitting there and you're reading the autarchy. How difficult can I be? I've been here, I've done that, you know, I've come... And then that first time when I was presenting and, you know, you're in the studio, you're on your own. Of course, there's a floor manager. But when that door goes clunk and someone says, right, you know, 30 seconds to air.
Just talk back in your ear.
It's talk back in your ear. It is really, really frightening.
I don't doubt it. I mean, as you know, I struggle through the intro now. What our listeners don't know is that I'll re-record the intro at the end of this and it'll be very cleverly edited in at the beginning. It's very difficult to read and get it right first time.
It is.
Particularly if there's millions of people watching it.
Absolutely.
I mean,
yeah.
If you even get one beat wrong, you're going to be doing that in front of millions of people. How do you manage the nerves? Or is that part of the adrenaline?
It's part of the adrenaline. You have a way of sort of, you know, sectioning your mind to sort of, you know, block that sort of out. I just get on with it. And if I make a mistake, I sort of make a mistake. Touch wood. I mean, of course I've made sort of mistake, but they haven't been sort of too, you know, noticeable. I think, I mean, I've not had any, maybe I shouldn't be talking about this actually, because next time I present I do enjoy it. It is seat of the pants though, for sure, because it's all on you. I mean, you know, you are anchoring, literally. I mean, that's the term used. And if it goes pear-shaped, it might not be your fault, but you've got to just carry on. I mean, Jeremy Paxman always tells a story of his famous interview with Michael Howard where he asked the same question lots of times.
You threatened to overrule him, the Derek Lewis one.
Exactly. But he was doing that because he was told that just keep asking, you know, question, because the next report's not ready. So he had to just keep... But of course, he then suddenly found he'd actually hit on something. But, you know, these kind of famous incidences do have sort of odd beginners. That's his version, anyway.
I remember the first time I ever was a guest on Sky News 5 at Live, Jeremy Thompson, who was one of my favourite news anchors, he interviewed me. I was trying to ban the sale of foie gras at the time. Mm. And there was a package, and then he kind of read it, and then he turned to me, and I remember the auto cue had what he had to read, and then it just said, ask Paul some questions. Yeah. And he just effortlessly turned around to me and said, so, you know, what are the legal implications of blah, blah, blah? And he clearly got no notes or no preparation. Yeah. And I was blown away by the professionalism of that, because I could clearly see the auto cue had ran out of stuff for him to say.
And there's probably three, four people talking in his ear at the same time,
and the viewer wouldn't have noticed a single beat. Yeah.
It's a real skill. It is seat of the pants, and much more frightening doing it than I ever thought it would be. And again, you know, it goes back. You know, it's incredibly exhilarating as well. You know,
when you come off air, you've got loads of adrenaline kind of going around.
Yeah, no, it definitely sort of takes a while.
You have to calm down.
You have to calm down. It takes a little while, sort of. You know, you don't just go home and go to sleep. You know, having presented the 10 o'clock news, you sort of have to sort of come down a little bit.
Tell us about the On Assignment series then. How do you put the programme together?
On Assignment came about from an idea that colleagues and senior sort of editors at ITV had. You know, we've got this amazing network of, you know, correspondents travelling, you know, all over the world, you know, telling stories. But what about, you know, making use of that kind of asset in a different way and communicating a different type of storytelling, you know, relaying international affairs and stories to an audience that isn't just constricted by, you know, having to do something because it's on that day's sort of news agenda. Because when you were asking me earlier, what are the things that really stay with you? It's those little sort of moments, like I was saying about visiting Nelson Mandela's house. The best stories, the most fascinating things are the ones sometimes that just never make it on air. That's why journalists end up writing a lot of sort of books, because you don't want that, you know, to be lost. You know, those journeys you made, those amazing sort of people that will never make it into the news, but really tell you something enlightening about a society or a country. So that's what On Assignment is. It's a half-hour program. It's three reports by three correspondents who are able to sort of cover a multitude of different things. They can be very, you know, serious sort of subjects. Robert Moore did an amazing story very early on before very few people had sort of covered it, about the opiates addiction in the United States.
And, amazing,
you know,
journalist.
Absolutely.
I actually vaguely remember that.
It was just extraordinary sort of story. Then we've done other things. You know, Debbie Edward did this story about, it's an issue about mental health in Indonesia, but where people suffering from, you know, mental health issues were shackled. I mean, in chains. I mean, you know, tied to, you know, in awful sort of conditions, and the access that she got, and the sort of, you know, the empathy and delicate way in which she told that story was incredibly amazing. One of the stories that I really am incredibly proud to that was on assignment was by, you know, John Ray, who was a South Africa correspondent. I just told the story. It's called Vicky's Story, about a girl who had undergone the most incredible sort of abuse. I mean, in a sort of, you know, township, and it, you know, was won the One World sort of, you know, award. And it really told you about the bleak, desperate sort of plight of many children growing up in, you know, the townships of South Africa, which had suffered, you know, abuse. And it was just incredibly sort of told. But there are also other really great stories that would never make it on air. There was, you know, these ultra marathon runners from Afghanistan. You know, Vladimir Putin's favorite bike gang. We did a lovely story about this sort of village, basically, in Italy, which has the highest number of people in their 90s. And they're part of a sort of a really big scientific study. Why is it that, you know, so many people in this particular sort of small village in Italy live to be over 90 years old?
My friend, Dr. Asim Al-Hotra, has actually written a book about after that village.
Yeah. You know, dynamite fishing in sort of, you know, Tanzania. It's a kind of thing you can watch that we hope gives you little sort of stories that are, you know, often will go untold, but that, you know, make international affairs and what's happening in the world accessible. You know, that doesn't just have to be mayhem, destruction, upheaval and so forth. Just, you know.
Do you feel a huge sense of gratitude that, you know, given that you've seen so much, frankly, so much human suffering, that, you know, I can watch one of your reports and then I can be in Starbucks the next day and the person in front of me is arguing with the barista because there's not enough milk in their latte. And I think, wow, we really do need to get a grip as a society about how lucky we are. Has this journey changed you as a person?
It has, in many different sort of ways, and yet it's kind of just reinforced things as well. I mean, I sort of talk about just what an amazing, you know, it's not just about being optimistic, but, you know, I've walked away, Paul, from lots of stories thinking, when will this country, you know, ever pick itself, you know, up? How can, you know, you we'll go home tonight, we'll switch on the TV and they'll, you know, we'll see heartrending sort of report about Syria and sort of, you know, utter, look at, you know, the cities look like Dresden, you know, after the, you think, when can life ever return in a way that allows people to have a positive sort of life? But they always do. You know, I've walked away from lots of different sort of, you know, Bosnia is now one of the leading tourist destinations in, you know, Europe, you know. Mozambique is just a, you know, I remember covering the floods in Mozambique, you know, 1999, thinking, you know, this is going to devastate, you know, people's ability to sort of live and, you know, function thousands. But life is getting better, you know, from when I sort of started, you know, my career to now, you know, let's talk about sort of, you know, Africa. You know, there's a huge middle class. Yes, of course, there was a, you know, a terrible drought, you know, in Somalia. But life expectancy has sort of, you know, gone up. Transportation, schooling, you know, there's so much that has, you know, happened. But don't forget, news is the reporting of the sudden, the extreme, the shocking. All this other stuff, you know, the fact that, you know, more children are going to school in sub-Saharan Africa. There are more, the highest number of, you know, dollar millionaires in any African city is in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. Mm. You and I, when we were growing up, equated, you know, Ethiopia with, of course, you know, hunger, famine, you know, no. I mean, you know, you go to Ethiopia now, it's unrecognizable. Those things don't get reported. They end up on my, you know, on our notebook, you know, the things that don't get sort of told. And that's kind of the things that we're trying, the kind of stories we're trying to tell in On Assignment. But I mean, how has it changed me? I think it's made me realize, you know, what a sort of charmed life I've sort of had, how lucky I have been.
Well, you've also earned it as well.
Yeah, that's true. But also I think, you know, we have, you know, it may not seem it, you know, especially in this sort of news cycle and, you know, this, you know, the world as it is in the moment, but actually there is a lot more things that humanity, people have in common than they would care to sort of realize. And that, you know, progress is not only possible, but is being made, you know, around the world. But we're all getting drawn together as well. I mean, the you know, when I started sort of, you know, journalism, in order to get to the quickest way to get from South Africa, where I was living in Johannesburg, to Nigeria, was to go via London. I remember being told, you got to go, there's a big story in Nigeria. We looked, you know, in our bureau, said, what's the quickest way we can get? We had to get a flight, you know, overnight flight from Johannesburg to London, switch, and then go straight down. That was quicker than going from Johannesburg. You know, that's not the case, you know, anymore. Always amazes me arriving back in London, and it's almost always sort of, you know, Heathrow that you sort of go through, or even going through Dubai. You know, I mean, in fact, I flew through Dubai back to London yesterday, and just seeing the languages that are being sort of spoken, the different sort of, you know, faces, and it reminds you, actually, I mean, it sounds very sort of, you know, marshmallowy and schmaltzy to say so, but you know, I'm left being an optimist about our world, even though I've covered a lot of stories that should make me think otherwise. But I'm not, after 25 years of doing it.
Last couple of questions then. How recognised are you? Because you're a journalist, you're in the public eye, you present the flagship news at 10.
Yeah.
You know, can you get the best restaurant tables? How recognised are you? I mean, the Americans actually called you the Scud Stud, as I remember, back in the years.
Yeah,
were you flattered by that? Or was that a kind of bit weird? Or?
Bit weird. Definitely on the big bit weird list. I mean, it's...
Can
it's
you
really
get the best restaurant tables? Can you walk in and say, don't you know who I am?
I'm a kebab man. You know, I don't really sort of... I love cooking, actually. I much prefer sort of cooking at sort of home. It's that's my sort of zen sort of moment is cooking. I quite like how I sort of, you know, de-stress, one of the things. But no, seriously, I do get recognised quite a bit. It's people are always nice, actually. I've not had anyone going,
you're not any weirdos.
No,
because you are off of the telly.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes there are funny sort of things. I was taking the dog for a walk one time, and I was walking along the sort of Thames sort of towpath. You know, I live in, you know, in West London, and it was a couple of Septembers ago, so conkers were sort of all along the sort of the towpath when I was walking. I just sort of kicked it, and the dog went after it. But of course, it bobbled along and went over the side. And the dog, you know, just decided to go after the conker. And I thought, no! And it was low tide. And there was a sort of, you know, and it's sort of, you know...
Quite a drop.
Well, it wasn't a seat drop. It was just like a bank. It was at a slope. But I mean, so I went over, and the dog was sort of there looking up at me, trying to scamper up. And I thought, come here. You know, I was trying to reach for this dog. Come here. And I couldn't reach it. It couldn't sort of reach me. And there were these two women who were sort of jogging along. And I said, look, because my dog's in there, can you help? You know? And they said, I tell you what, let's you just go down. We'll hold your leg. And you just, you know, go over and reach down. So these two women were holding me by sort of leg. And I was sort of, I managed to get the sort of, you know, dog by. And I thought, thank God, thank you so much. And he goes, oh, that's fine. He goes, I love your reporting, by the way. Just the most weird sort of bizarre sort of moments to sort of get recognised. And there are other times when I've been sort of, you know, my kids are young. I remember taking a call from a rebel group. They had my number. I'd sort of been with them travelling. and I'm back home, and it was my turn to go and do the shopping. So I was in aisle 9 of whatever it was, you know.
Near the salt and vinegar crisps.
So you're actually at the sort of, you know, in the toiletries and nappies. And so I was getting a call, Mr. Raggy, we're getting bombed, you know, it's a terrible situation, you have to... And I'm sort of like looking for the Suda cream and nappies at the same time. It's like, you know, I could hear the sort of sense of urgency. I mean, it is a very strange and weird life that you literally could be looking for the nappies and you'll get a call from some bloke who's saying, our rebel positions are under attack. I mean, if you wrote that in a book, you'd think, nah, it's just nonsense.
Do you look at, say, a report that Jeremy Bowen is doing on the BBC News at 10, and do you want to be there, or do you watch it as a viewer like I would, or do you, because you know behind the scenes, do you deconstruct it and think, oh, he's done that, or he's not done this?
A little bit, yeah, you do. I mean, definitely, because... you want to see what your sort of, you know, friends and competitors are sort of, you know, doing. Why have they led with that? So, of course, there is a bit of the sort of, you know, deconstructing and so forth. And, you know, you really admire, and you also pilfer ideas, you know, use of sound. You know, in fact, in some ways, when you're actually doing a television report, next time you're really, really grabbed, you know, by a powerful sort of report, just look back and I bet you it's amazing use of sound, natural sound. Little things like that. But on the whole, you do also sometimes think, God, Jeremy Bowen's got in there and, you know, I couldn't. And, you know what I mean? The time you think, I wish I was, you know, I was sort of going that, you know, lucky SOB, you know. But it's, it's a very competitive field. But at the same time, you know, it's people like sort of, you know, Jeremy Bowen are not only sort of amazing sort of journalists, but, you know, they know that, you know, no story is worth dying for. And I'm sure there have been times when you've had sort of lucky, you know, scrapes, and other times, sadly, you know, we've seen a lot of colleagues who, for whom that road or, you know, that building, you know, the choice they made, they were at the wrong place at the wrong time. Sometimes it just is that. I mean, on the whole, I'd say, you know, people sort of say, God, it must be cutthroat. You know, they're all trying to sort of... No, it's of course it is. It's competitive like that. But we all try and help each other at the same time. There's an enormous amount of sort of, you know, camaraderie. When push comes to shove, you know, the fact that we all want to be, you know, safe and help each other is far more important than getting on. Who will remember, you know, what report I did or Jeremy did back in, you know, 5 years ago? You see what I mean? You know, that's the other thing, is never, ever take yourself so seriously that you sort of think that, you know, a story is absolutely sort of worth putting any real sort of risk and danger for your lives, or more importantly, the lives of others.
Raggy, I could go on for another 2 or 3 hours with this. It's been fascinating.
Fun.
We've literally run out of metaphorical... We've not literally run out of metaphorical tape. I've ruined my own catchphrase there, but we're out of time, unfortunately. Thank you ever so much. It's been, it's been one of the most enjoyable I've done in a long time. It's been a pleasure. Thank you
so much. Thank you.
A Right Angles podcast in association with Big Things Media.